Chapter 12. Grace, conscience, and your daily experience. Thus far I have rather frequently mentioned the state of grace in the 636th session in Chapter 9, for instance, because while it has many dimensions it is, practically speaking, the cause of your sense of well-being and accomplishment. It is a condition of your existence. Each of you may put the following in your own terms, but often it may seem as if your conscience tells you that you have fallen out of grace, and that some inner, mysterious, joyous sense of support no longer sustains you. Unfortunately, conscience as you think of it is an untrustworthy guide, speaking to you through the mouths of mothers and fathers, teachers and clergy, all perhaps from distant years, and each of whom had their own ideas of what was right and wrong for you and for humanity at large. These people of course were, and are, quite fallible. When you are a child however adults seem godlike. Their words fall with great weight because you are so at the mercy of their support. As a child it was quite necessary that you accept beliefs from others before your conscious mind could form its own. You accepted the concepts for your own reasons. Those given beliefs represent the spiritual and mental fabric of ideas, the raw material, so to speak, with which you have to work. In adolescence certain beliefs will be easily and immediately abandoned or altered to fit the expanding pattern of experience. Still other beliefs will remain, with perhaps certain elements being changed. The beliefs may be revised to fit your new image, for example, while the main pattern remains the same. Let us consider the idea of original sin, all of the colorful forms it may take within your body of concepts, and the ways in which these will affect your behavior and experience. The concept itself existed long before Christianity's initiation, and was told in various forms throughout the centuries and in all civilizations. On the side of consciousness, it is a tale symbolically representing the birth of the conscious mind in the species as a whole, and the emergence of self-responsibility. It also stands for the separation of the self who perceives, and therefore judges and values, from the object which is perceived and evaluated. It represents the emergence of the conscious mind and of the strongly oriented individual self from that ground of being from which all consciousness comes. It portrays the new consciousness seeing itself unique and separate, evolving from the tree of life and therefore able to examine its fruits, to see itself for the first time as different from others, like the serpent who crawled upon the surface of the earth. Man came forth as a creature of distinctions. In so doing he quite purposefully detached himself, in your terms now, from the body of his planet in a new way. A part of him very naturally yearned for that primeval, louder, knowing unknowingness that had to be abandoned, in which all things were given, no judgments or distinctions were necessary, and all responsibilities were biologically foreordained. He saw himself as rising above the serpent, which was a symbol of unconscious knowledge. Yet the serpent would always mystify and attract man, even though he must stand upon its head, symbolically speaking, and rise from its knowledge. With the birth of this consciousness came conscious responsibility for the fruits of the planet. Man became the caretaker. The serpent is the symbol of the deepest knowledge within creaturehood. It also contains the impetus to rise above or beyond itself in certain respects. Eve, rather than Adam, for example, eats of the apple first because it was the intuitive elements of the race, portrayed in the story as female, that would bring about this initiation. Only afterward could the ego, symbolized by Adam, attain its new birth and its necessary alienation. The tree of knowledge, then, did indeed offer its fruits, and, good and bad, because this was the first time there were any kinds of choices available, and free will. There were other tales, some that have not come down to you, in which Adam and Eve were created together, and in a dream fell apart into the separate male and female. In your particular legend Adam appears first. The woman being created from his rib symbolized the necessary emergence, even from the new creature, of the intuitive forces that will always come forth, for without that development the race would not have attained self-consciousness in your terms. Good and evil then simply represented the birth of choices, initially in terms of survival, where earlier instinct alone had provided all that was needed. In deeper terms, there is still another meaning that mirrors all of those apparent divisions that occur as all that is seemingly separates portions of itself from itself, scattering its omnipotence into new patterns of being that, in your terms, remember their source and look back to it longingly, while still glorying in the unique individually that is their own. The story of the fall, the rebellious angels, and the leader Satan who becomes the devil, all of this refers to the same phenomena on a different level. Satan represents, In the terms of the story, the part of all that is, or God, who stepped outside of himself, so to speak, and became earthbound with his creatures, offering them the free will and choice that, previously, had not been available. Hence you have the majestic elements given to Satan, and the power. The earthly characteristics often appear as he is depicted in animal form, for he was also of course connected with the intuitive terrestrial attributes from which the new human consciousness would spring. In terms of simple biological function, you now have a species no longer completely dependent upon instinct, yet still with all the natural built-in desires for survival, and the appearance within it of a mind able to make decisions and distinctions. This new kind of consciousness brought with it the open mirror of memory in which past joy and pain could be recalled, and so the realization of mortal death became more immediate than it was with the animals. An association could trigger the clear memory of a past agony in the bewildered new mind. At first, there was a difficulty in separating the remembered image from the moment in the present. Man's mind then struggled to contain many images, past, present, and future imagined ones, and was forced to correlate these in any given moment of time. A vast acceleration took place. It was only natural that certain experiences would seem better than others, but the species' new abilities made it necessary that sharp distinctions be made. Good and evil, the desirable and the less so, were invaluable aids then in helping form the basis for such operations. The birth of imagination initiated the largest possibilities, and at the same time put great strain upon the biological creature whose entire corporeal structure would now react not only to present objective situations, but imaginative ones. At the same time, members of the species had to cope with the natural environment as did any other animal. Imagination helped because an individual could anticipate the behavior of other creatures. In another way, animals also possess an unconscious anticipation, but they do not have to come to terms with it on an aware basis as the new consciousness did. Again, good and evil and the freedom of choice came to the species' aid. The evil animal was the natural predator. For example, it would help here if the reader remembers what has been said about natural guilt earlier in this book. It would aid in understanding the later myths and the variations that came from them. In Chapter 8, among others, as the mind developed, the species could hand down to its offspring the wisdom and law of the elders. This is still being done in modern society, of course, when each child inherits the beliefs of its parents about the nature of reality. Apart from all other considerations, this is also a characteristic of creaturehood. Only the means are different with the animals. The acceleration continues, however. Ideas of right and wrong are always guidelines that are then individually interpreted. Because of the connection with survival mentioned earlier, in the last session, there is a great charge here. Initially, the child had to be impressed with the fact, for example, that a predator animal was bad because it could kill. Today, a mother might unwittingly say the same thing about a car. The early acquiescence to beliefs has a biological importance, therefore, but as the conscious mind attains its maturity, it is also natural for it to question those beliefs, and to assess them in relation to its own environment. Many of my readers may have certain ideas about good and evil that are very hampering. These may be old beliefs in new clothing. You may think that you are quite free, only to discover that you hold old ideas but have simply put new terms to them, or concentrated upon other aspects. Your daily experience is intimately connected with your ideas of worth and personal value. You may be quite able to see through the distortions of conventional Christianity. You may have changed your ideas to such an extent that you can see little similarity between your current ones and those of the past. Now you may believe in the theories of Buddhism, for example, or of another Eastern philosophy. The differences between any of those systems of thought and Christianity may be so apparent that the similarities escape you. You may follow one of the schools of Buddhism in which great stress is laid upon the denial of the body, discipline of the flesh, and the avoidance of desire. These elements are quite characteristic of Christianity also, of course, but they may appear more palatable, exotic, or reasonable coming from a source foreign to your childhood education. So you may leap from one to the other, shouting emancipation and feeling yourself quite free of old limiting ideas. Philosophies that teach denial of the flesh must ultimately end up preaching a denial of the self and building a contempt for it, because even though the soul is couched in muscle and bone, it is meant to experience that reality, not to refute it. All such dogmas use artificial guilt, and natural guilt is distorted to serve those ends. In whatever terms, The devotee is told that there is something wrong with earthly experience. You are, therefore, considered evil as a self in flesh by virtue of your very existence. This alone will cause adverse experience, making you reject the very basis of your own framework of experience. You will consider the body as a thing, a fine vehicle but not in itself the natural living expression of your being in material form. Many such Eastern schools also stress, as do numerous spiritualistic schools, the importance of the unconscious levels of the self, and teach you to mistrust the conscious mind. The concept of nirvana, in Chapter 9, and the idea of heaven are two versions of the same picture, the former being one in which individuality is lost in the bliss of undifferentiated consciousness, and the latter one in which still conscious individuals perform mindless adoration. Neither theory contains an understanding of the functions of the conscious mind, or the evolution of consciousness, or, for that matter, certain aspects of greater physics. No energy is ever lost. The expanding universe theory applies to the mind as well as to the universe. The Big Bang theory postulates that 10 to 15 billion years ago all matter, or energy, was concentrated in one great primordial atom. This colossus exploded, and the still expanding universe we see today is the aftermath of that event. One variation of the theory considered a pulsating universe that results from the repeated collapsing and expanding of all matter energy. However, these philosophies can lead you to a deep mistrust of both your body and mind. You are told that the spirit is perfect, and so you can try to live up to standards of perfection quite impossible to achieve. The failure adds to the sense of guilt. You attempt then to further banish the characteristic enjoyment of your own creaturehood, denying the lusty spirituality of your flesh and the strong present corporeal leanings of your soul. You will try to rid yourself of very natural emotions, and so be cheated of their great spiritual and physical motion. Pause. On the other hand, some leaders may give little consideration to such issues, but still be deeply convinced of the misery of the human condition, focusing upon all the darker elements, seeing the world's destruction ever closer to hand without really examining the beliefs that arouse such constant feelings. They may find it easy to cluck their tongues at obvious fanatics who cry out for God's vengeance, and speak about the world's end in brimstone and ashes. They may be as equally convinced, however, of man's basic unworthiness, and so of course of their own. In daily life such people will concentrate upon negative events, store them up, and unfortunately cause personal experience that will seem to quite reinforce the basic ideas. Here in different contexts is the same denial of the worth and integrity of earth experience. In some such cases, all of the desirable human attributes are magnified and projected outward into a god or superconsciousness, while all the less admirable characteristics are left to the race and the individual. The individual therefore deprives himself of the use of much of his ability. He does not consider it his own, and is astounded when any others of his race display such superior qualities. To some extent, such beliefs follow certain rhythms in both civilizations and in time. The mind is a system of checks and balances even as the body, and so often a set of beliefs that can be seen as highly negative will often serve beneficial ends in countering other beliefs. For some time Western civilization stressed a distorted version of intellectual reasoning, for example, and so the current stress about other portions of the self serves a purpose. The people alive within the world come into it with their own problems and challenges, and this will have much to do with the kind of national and worldwide beliefs that are generated and that dominate. The beliefs, of course, are frameworks in which various kinds of experience are tested. This also applies to religions, and political and social situations as well. There is always a give and take between the individual and the mass system of beliefs in which he has chosen his environment. There is a belief in illness as being morally wrong, and a countering belief in it as being ennobling, uplifting and spiritually good. These value judgments are extremely important, for they will be reflected in your own experience with any illness or disease. There are too many aspects of what you think of as health and illness to discuss even in a book that is directed to personal reality, in which the body plays such an important role. Health and illness are both evidences of the body's attempt to maintain stability. There is a difference in the overall health patterns in men and animals because of the quite diverse nature of their physical experience. More will be said about this particular subject later. Overall, however, in the animals illness and disease play a life-giving role, keeping balance both within a species and between them, therefore ensuring the future existence of all involved. In their own ways, the animals are quite aware of this fact, Some of them even bring themselves to their own destruction through what you would call suicide, and en masse. At that level the animals understand, and are always in touch with deep biological connections in which they know their own continuances within the chain of nature. Man grants rich psychological activity to his own species but denies it in others. There are as many luxuriant and diverse kinds of psychological movement as there are species, however, the cycles of health and disease are felt as rhythms of the body by the large variety of animals, and even with them illness or disease has life-saving qualities on another level. Instinct is fairly accurate, for example, guiding the beast to those territories in which proper conditions can be found, and even for them the well-being of the body represents physical evidence of their being them the proper place at the proper time. It reinforces the animal's sense of grace in terms mentioned earlier in this book. In Chapter 9, they understand the beneficial teaching quality of disease and follow their own instinctive ways of treating it. In a natural situation, this might involve a mass migration from one territory to another. In such cases, the illness of only a few animals might send a whole herd to its safety and a new food supply. Man is so highly verbal that he finds it difficult to understand that other species work with idea complexes, with a hyphen of a different kind, in which of course thought as you consider it is not involved. But an equivalent exists. Using an analogy, it is as if ideas are built up not through sentence structure reinforced by inner visual images, but by like mental pattern structured through touch and scent, in other words, thinking, but within a framework entirely different and alien to you. Such thinking exists, using the analogy, within the framework of instinct, whereas your own verbalized thoughts can also intrude outside of that framework. One of the main differences between you and the animals, and one of the significant meanings in terms of free will, is involved here. Animals, then, understand the beneficial directing elements of disease. They also comprehend the nature of stress as a necessary stimulant to physical activity. Observing even a pet, you will notice its marvelous complete relaxation, and yet its immediate total response to stimulus. So animals in captivity will fight to provide themselves with necessary health-giving stress factors. Animals, then, do not think of illness in terms of good or bad. Disease in itself on that level is a part of the life survival process, and a system of checks and balances. With the emergence of man's particular kind of consciousness, other issues become involved. Mankind feels its own mortality even more than the beasts do. With the growth of this particular variety of self-consciousness came the exteriorization, magnification and intensification of definite elements that lie latent in other animals, the individuation of strong emotional activity to a new degree, for example, the emergence of the pause of reflection mentioned earlier in the 635th session in Chapter 8, for instance, and the blossoming of memory along with the emotional intensification, led to a situation in which members of the new species recalled, in the present, the dead and the diseases that killed them. They became frightened of disease, particularly in the case of plagues. Man forgot the teaching and healing elements, and concentrated instead upon the unpleasant experience itself. To some extent, this was quite natural, for the new species developed in order to change the nature of its consciousness, to follow a reality in which instinct was no longer blindly followed, and to individualize in strong personal focus corporeal experience that had previously taken a different pattern. Man has a far greater leeway. He forms his reality according to his conscious beliefs, even while its basis lies in the deep unconscious nature of the earth in corporeal terms. Man's I am, seemingly apart from nature, a characteristic necessary for the development of his kind of consciousness, led him into valued judgments, and also necessitated some break with the deep inner certainties of other species. Illness therefore was experienced as bad. An entire tribe could be endangered by one sick member. At the same time, as the mind developed, cunning and memory became highly effective survival tools. In some societies or tribes, the old or infirm were killed lest their care take too much attention from the able-bodied and endanger the group. In others, however, the old were honored for the wisdom that they had accumulated with age, and this became very practical in tribes where many did not survive. History was dependent upon the old with their memory of past events, and the group's sense of continuity was also in the hands of its oldest members, who passed memories on to others. An individual who had himself survived many diseases was considered a sage. Such people often watched the animals and observed nature's own therapies and treatments. In certain eras, the lines between the species were not completely drawn, and there were long periods where men and animals mixed and learned from each other. Man's imagination made him a great maker of myths. Myths as you know them represent bridges of psychological activity, and point quite clearly to patterns of perception and behavior through which, in your terms, the race passed as it traveled to its present state. Mythology bridges the gap between instinctive knowledge and the individualization of idea. When an animal is sick, it immediately begins to remedy the situation, and unconsciously it knows what to do. It does not bother thinking in your terms of good and evil. It does not wonder what it did to get into such a situation. It does not think of itself as inferior. It automatically begins its own therapy. A human being, however, has another dimension to deal with, a new area of creativity, a diverse mixture of beliefs. His or her ideas about the self must be examined, for they are being materialized in flesh. Again, the situation has great complexity, for the condition is still a healthy attempt on the part of the body to maintain balance. Overall, there is also the world situation to be taken into consideration, the status of the species on the planet, in which, say, overpopulation problems will bring about death to ensure new growth. The individuals alive at such a time will also have a hand in such decisions. However, once more, because you are self-conscious beings, your beliefs regulate your reality. An animal knows unconsciously that it is unique and has a place in the scheme of being. Its sense of grace is built in. Your free will allows for the freedom of any belief, including one that says you are unworthy, with no right to your existence. If you misinterpret the myths, then you may believe that man has fallen from grace and that his very creaturehood is cursed, in which case you will not trust your body or allow it its natural pattern of self-therapy. In order for consciousness to develop in your terms, there must be freedom for the exploration of all ideas individually and en masse. Each of you are living entities, growing toward your own development. Each of your beliefs, therefore, has its own unique origin and feeling patterns, so you must for yourself travel back through your beliefs and your own feelings until intellectually and emotionally you realize your tightness, your completely original existence in time and space as you know it. This knowing will give you the conscious knowledge that is a counterpart of the animal's unconscious comprehension. An animal has no need of conscience, in any terms. Because of the great flexibility of your natures, however, mankind needs a framework in which the ramifications of what I have referred to as normal healthy guilt can be considered. What you consider conscience is often an applied from without sense of right and wrong instilled in you in your youth. As a rule, these ideas represent your parents' conceptions of natural guilt, distorted by their own beliefs. See the 619th session in chapter 4, as well as the first session in this chapter. You accepted those ideas for a reason, individually and en masse. For mankind at any given time has a strong idea of the particular sort of world experience it will create. Because you have free will, you have the responsibility and the gift, the joy and the necessity, of working with your beliefs and of choosing our personal reality as you desire. I told you earlier, in the 636th session in chapter 9, that you cannot fall out of a state of grace. Each of you must intellectually and emotionally accept it, however. While this may seem like the sheerest Pollyanna, nevertheless, there is no evil in basic terms. This does not mean that you do not meet with effects that appear evil, but as you each move individually through the dimensions of your own consciousness, you will understand that all seeming opposites are other faces of the one supreme drive toward creativity. At any given time, there will be various climates of belief pervading the world. Some will be clustered in certain areas, for example, like low-pressure systems. Some will generally be local, and others will sweep across the continents like great periodic storms. Remember that ideas are as natural as the weather. They follow patterns, then, and obey certain laws even as more strictly physical phenomena do. Unfortunately, no one examines the nature of mental reality from such a viewpoint. You will be born in the midst of certain mass beliefs, and these may vary according to the country of your nativity. As you come into your body with all of its physical surroundings, so at birth do you emerge into a rich natural psychological environment in which beliefs and ideas are every bit as real. As you become more proficient at using your conscious mind, then of course you examine the beliefs that surround you, even as you question and often move out of your native environment. You may migrate to a climate in which the prevailing ideas suit you better, as well as the weather. Regardless, there are certain tendencies, mental stances, that you will take about yourself, your body and your life to one degree or another. Many of these will be directly or indirectly connected with old myths and beliefs of your forefathers. Your ideas of good and evil as applied to health and illness are highly important. For instance, pause. Few can escape putting value judgments in such areas. If you consider illness as a kind of moral stigma, then you will simply add an unneeded quality to any condition of ill health. Such judgments are very simplistic, and ignore the great range of human motivation and experience. If you are bound and determined that God, in capitals and quotes, creates only good, then any physical deficiency, illness or deformity becomes an affront to your belief, threatens it, and makes you angry and resentful. If you become ill, you can hate yourself for not being what you think you should be, a perfect physical image made in the likeness of a perfect God. If on the other hand you carry the idea too far, that illness can also be a learning process, then you can fall into the other extreme, glorifying sickness or disease as a necessary ennobling experience in which the body is purged so that the soul can be saved. Following such a belief, you will confuse suffering with saintliness, desolation with purity, and the denial of the body as spirituality and a badge of holiness. Under such conditions, you can even seek out illness to prove to yourself the strength of your own spirituality, and to impress it upon others. The same kind of moral value judgment can be placed in almost any area of human activity, and will of course have social repercussions. Those reactions will add to the prevailing beliefs and in turn affect the individual. You may believe that wealth is a result of a moral virtue, and comes from God's direct benevolence. As a result, poverty becomes evidence of a lack of morality. God made so many people poor that obviously no man should dare try to change the situation. That rationale is often used. The poor, then, following these beliefs, are looked down upon as are the diseased. What sin did the poor person or the sick person commit? That question, often asked unconsciously, if not consciously, brings you back to beliefs in punishment that have nothing to do with the concept of natural guilt, but with those distortions placed upon it. There is also a connection with misinterpretation of the Bible. Christ, as you think of him, was simply saying that you form your own reality. He tried to rise above the idea systems of those times, yet even he had to use them, and so the connotations of sin and punishment distorted the message given. Some of you will have a contradictory belief that poverty is virtuous, and that wealth is a vice and represents evidence of a spiritual lack. See the 614th session in Chapter 2. This belief in your society also harks back to the Bible and Christ's association with the poor rather than the rich. In all such cases, however, blanket moral judgments are being applied that involve feelings of guilt in which individual experience is forgotten. Such critical evaluations are placed upon colors as well. Often white is considered pure, and black impure, white good and black evil. This of course involves considerations of race, and you must realize that your present race is the one into which you were born, in your terms, in this place and time. Each of you have been members of different races, and so each of you have shared in both the advantages and ignominies attached, in historic terms, to such conditions of birth. This is not the place for me to go into a long discussion concerning the significance of races, yet each one is highly meaningful, and represents a different aspect of humanity as a whole. Therefore, each race has a symbolic meaning to mankind's psyche. The outside experience and structure of any given race's experience may change, but the inner symbolism will still remain, and be creatively grappled with. Your daily experience will be affected by your race, your beliefs about it, your beliefs about other races, and the climate of opinion in general. On a quite simple basis, if you consider God in human terms, you will project him as belonging to your own race. If you belong to a minority or if you are black, then you may be caught in a conflict of beliefs. It is impossible to separate your daily experience in any of its aspects from your beliefs and those judgments that you place upon them. The beliefs boil down to your ideas of right and wrong, and they involve all of your attitudes concerning illness and health, wealth and poverty, the relationships of the races, religious conflicts, and more important, your intimate day-by-day psychological reality. Let us pursue this subject further as it involves you personally at those levels in which you live your lives and intermix with others.